ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
Global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
We're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming.
Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a typical superhero story, from the rolling green hills of Country Island to literally studying Mars and the extremophiles that could survive the radiation of space.
If they get me a one-way ticket, I'd probably take it. You know, like if you end up on Mars or the moon or whatever, because what could beat that?
I'm playing Pac-Man with living algae along the way.
The red thing eating the yellow things.
Your superhero of science for this episode is Dr. Diane Purcell.
That's interesting. So
these days, her Clark Kent-like alter ego is at the EPA in Tassie, but her glowing green cape as a phycologist is made of mysterious algae.
She said to me, "You might get your name on one of these species," and I was like, "Ooh, if that's the case, this is obviously the field for me."
And she's got quite the turn of phrase.
I don't want to put, like, steroids up, you know, the arse of a poodle for the rest of my career, Dad. Like, I'm not doing it.
This episode of What the Duck was made at a time when the Earth needs heroes. And each superhero I know of has an origin story. The four young turtles crawled out of green ooze. And He-Man was a gift for toy sales. I mean, by the power of Grayskull. We don't need more myths. We need real heroes. Nature superheroes. Where would they come from?
So I grew up in Country Ireland, surrounded by fields and farms. Golden Vale, best land you can ever come across, really, in Ireland.
This is a promising start for a superhero to emerge from. And this is What the Duck. I'm Anne Jones, and you're listening to Diane Purcell, a woman driven to extremes.
Pretty simplistic environment. I was the youngest of five kids. My mum was a midwife, I think she wanted to go for more, but my dad said that was it. That's the end of that. So five is enough, even though that's a very small family in Ireland in the 70s. You know, we had a client who had 14 kids, you know, which was definitely the top end of the scale. So Country Ireland, went to the local Catholic school, taught by nuns. I always wanted to be part of what was going on. I was about 3.5 years younger than my sister, and I always felt like I was too small. We had a kind of an attic where my dad threw, you know, some chipboard down on the floor. He got a tennis table and a pool table and he put it up there. And to be involved in the pool, I ended up racking the balls. That was about as close to the action as you got.
Yeah.
We always had dogs and cats. I don't know where any of them came from. My dad would just basically, I'd say, where did this, I fell off the back of a lorry. Everything fell off the back of a lorry. I have no idea.
Diane's dad was the local vet, and when her aptitude for science became evident, she discussed whether veterinary medicine might be a career that she could handle.
And I said to my dad, I said, "Well, I don't want to put, like, steroids up, you know, the arse of a poodle for the rest of my career, Dad. Like, I'm not doing it. It's not happening."
And that was that, but much more poetically than could have been anticipated.
I like the research. I love the animals. So I was always outside with nature and I was always working with my dad. It was always kind of part and parcel of where you lived.
So the mission was clear for a young Diane. Find a way to study the natural world that wasn't veterinary science. And to do that, you're going to have to leave home. But to where?
I just saw a video. Because this is back in the day. Oh, there's a video. Oh, there's this cool little... And they've an old college that looks a bit like, nowadays, it looks a bit like something like Hogwarts, kind of cool on the coast. It was a very stony beach in Wales.
It was Aberystwyth University, perched against the ocean in Wales.
So got in there, we had a guy, a lecturer called Dr. Donston, who basically looked like Doc Brown out of Back to the Future. He'd worked in Africa, he'd worked everywhere. So he was a real kind of as somebody to look up to. And got into my zoology degree. And then this year an employment scheme option came up.
This is a chance to be putting things into practice and work in the real world before the final year of your undergrad degree. But they're very specific job opportunities.
One was lifting some kind of, I don't know, backpack thing through the tundra in Alaska, which I thought sounded fantastic. And then there was some kind of boat ship thing. I don't know what it was, something about taking samples at sea. And I thought, oh, yeah. And then there was a position in a lab at Imperial College in London for a year. And I was like, ooh, what's this? And it was a microbial ecology lab. And I didn't really know what they were doing or whatever.
Like any good super science hero origin story, there is fate. And it was acting on Diane's uni employment scheme. Because maybe fate is also bureaucratic and about resource allocation.
So I got a year in this lab and started working. These people looking at like green vials, green goo in the incubator, and started, oh, they're looking really lovely today. And I was thinking, wow, I've just stepped into some kind of asylum or something. You know, who are these people and what is going on?
At Imperial College too, a super prestigious place to study or work.
It's the Department of Biology is on a big country estate about an hour from London, very close to Ascot Racecourse, and borders Windsor Park. The Queen lives across the road with her monk deer.
Oh, wow.
As you do. And so, yeah, I ended up in this beautiful lab and all the kit, you know, all the mod cons, which I didn't realise how good they were until I ended up in other labs afterwards.
And all the algae, well, some of the algae anyway. The green stuff that the researchers were ogling each day was algae, and soon Diane would also be interested in whether it was happy or not.
My boss was interested in different species. Things like the microbial ecology were still being very much investigated. We knew about, I don't know, I think they said something like we know 20 or 30% of the species at the time. We don't really know anything about an awful lot of them. There's loads to learn. You might find this really interesting. She said to me, well, you might get your name on one of these species. And I was like, ooh, geez, well, if that's the case, this is obviously the field for me.
Was there a moment that you can pinpoint where algae really hooked your brain?
This particular lab, all of a sudden you're looking down a microscope. This particular experience was amazing. We had the really excellent microscopes and we didn't really have screens at the time. We just looked down the microscope and we had like fluorescence and we had different facilities so that we could see chlorophyll staining up red under a UV light. So this work that I did in this lab was on mixotrophs, which are algae that eat bacteria and they photosynthesize as well. So they make their food from light harvesting, basically. These ones do crazy stuff. They have diurnal cycles, so they can tell nighttime from daytime.
The team set up an experiment to confuse that cycle, because while the algae can eat bacteria and photosynthesize, they don't do both of them all the time. They do either of them when they need to. So in this experiment, the algae was put into the dark.
So they would stop basically understanding the difference between light and day. And they turned into like fat eating, like they just ate and ate because they didn't know if it was morning or night and they couldn't tell because you'd taken away all their light. So she did that with one group. And then the other, the same species, we did normal. We just gave it normal conditions, so light and day conditions. And then we fed them fluorescently labelled bacteria. Us old people who understand Pac-Man. So imagine the red thing eating the yellow things. So that's, yeah, to count these algae doing this for 24 hours.
24 hours?
You do this for literally 24 hours with a 15-minute break every hour. And then I think we've got half an hour in the middle. That was it. That my old thesis became circadian rhythms in these microzophytic algae.
Wait. What algae?
So these particular types of algae are called chrysophytes. They're a particular group of algae, but all distantly connected in the sense that one really liked eating and the other one didn't. So one would play with its food and eat an odd bacteria if it's really stuck and it's absolutely desperate for food. And the other end is the Pac-Man, the top Pac-Man, who's munch, munch, munch. And then some of them got so excited that they would explode.
What?
They would be so hungry that you'd be counting these cells eating these other things. And myself and my workmates, so one of us was writing and one person was looking down the microscope and we go 23, 24, 25 and then you go pop. And we're like, oh, it exploded.
Wow. Just like the experienced phycologist earlier in the lab across the road from the Queen and her deer, Diane soon had favourites and her less favourites. Algae, not colleagues.
There's a lot of microbes, especially things that end up in your tummy. For example, there's a lot of bacteria and different organisms that can kind of live within a human body and they don't have any ability to photosynthesize. They are just ugly.
Oh.
In my personal opinion, they're ugly, white, gooey looking, boring things.
Again, the microorganisms, not the colleagues.
And then with the algae, like, they're just so pretty. Like, they really are just, there's one particular species called Dinah Bryan, which was one we had to use in this experiment. And this was the one who didn't want to eat the food at all. It was like the bowl child, who just wouldn't eat the lunch. And they have, it's kind of an interesting shape, not even star shaped, just two triangles like stuck together. And then it has two lovely little flagella, which are basically things that allow it to move. When it wants to sit within a group, like a colony in the middle of the, in a natural environment, it'll actually create like a heart shape. It's just the prettiest thing. And then when you look down the microscope, they're red. And then, as I say, you're trying to see if they're going to eat this one, look, fluorescently labeled bacteria. So you're trying to see if, you're like, one. And you're like, just either eat it or don't eat it. And it'll play with its food.
Wow.
Yeah, the flagella are cool because one's short, one's long. And they create a little vortex. So they spin together like little hairs. And then they'll pull it in. And then you'd think it's going to eat it, and then it spits it back out. And you're like, yeah. Dinah Bryan were terribly uncooperative. It was a great experiment, like really interesting. And it's what you learn. I find it interesting.
It clearly had a large impact on you, because from there you've gone into algae as your main academic interest. But you also seem to be in part following your nose through academia, or following what opportunities presented themselves. So you find yourself in America next.
Well, yeah. What happened was during that experiments, my boss at the time, she had a colleague from NASA, and she came over during these experiments because she was doing what we call C14. So C14, people know a lot about now, of carbon dating. You can use it as well within our experiments to see where the carbon is going in the algae. So it'll actually label the carbon. So if they are doing like we're doing, where they're eating or they're photosynthesizing, you can be like, okay, the carbon's going in here, or it's going into this part of the body or this part.
In the context of space exploration, this absorption of carbon could be extremely useful. It could create a life support system, maybe for a long, long journey, or maybe to support human life on another planet.
And so she said, well, I work in Yellowstone, you know, and I'm running a lab at NASA, and would you be interested in coming over and working for me? And I was like, oh, that sounds great. So, and this is like 4 o'clock in the morning when we're counting the crazy algae that are either eating or not eating and not behaving.
Almost every decision I've made at 4 a.m. has been a bad one, but not for Diane. No, because she's got super science skills.
So the Yellowstone Resources Center had a volunteer position, so I worked there for the summer. And then I would go out with an ornithologist, or I would go out with the archaeologists, or I would go out with whomever each week and see what they were up to. And at the end of the summer, my colleague from NASA, Lynn, had said, hey, you know, when you finish your degree, see how you go, get back to me. So towards the end of that year, I got in touch with her, and her husband works for the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Institute. So he had a research associate's position.
Yes, duckers, aliens have entered the chat.
So I applied for that, and I got into NASA and started working on an area called astrobiology. Extremophiles, which is basically dry lakes in Antarctica, all of the weird environments, whether it's Tibet or whether it's the Atacama Desert or whether it's polar ice caps or whether it's Antarctica, all the weird species live in those tougher environments. And yeah, so she was working on analogues to Mars, and the Mars missions were starting, and I ended up working in her lab.
We've hit the edge of science where it's hard not to draw science fiction pictures in your own mind at the same time. But the idea is that the organisms that live in the most extreme places on the planet could conceivably live in other extreme places out there.
And we've taken samples from hot springs in Yellowstone. So that's how that all...
I mean, it's interesting because Yellowstone is obviously an incredible environment. And there are extremophiles there. I'm beginning to get the feeling that you yourself want to be an extremophile scientist and go to all the places.
If I want to go there, I got to go work there. So that's it. With research, you absolutely, you know, it's backpack career all the way. You're young and you're probably a little bit dumb in some ways, and you're just happy to go anywhere and do anything.
It's all exciting, especially in that early period of your career.
Absolutely.
NASA, or like people who are interested in space, would be interested in extremophiles. They'd be interested in algae for the exact abilities that you're talking about in that first piece of research that you participated in, which is the ability to potentially change modes, to do things differently in different environments under different pressures.
So yeah, that was it. At the time, as I say, the Martian missions were starting, the whole selection of which rover was going to go up to Mars was all being looked into. There was a concern, definitely, that they weren't sure what they were going to find. We were working in Yellowstone at cosmic radiation. We didn't have cosmic radiation in Yellowstone. We had high UV because we were at altitude. So we were at between 7 and 10,000 feet. You've got algae there that basically are under really in the middle of the summer with all the sunlight, but you know what we used to call 16/8, so 16 hours of daylight, and you have high amounts of the ultraviolet radiation that's hitting the algae. Also, the beginning of the world of sunscreen and having algae in sunscreen, that was also part and parcel of that era. The pigments that the algae have, the colours that the algae have ability definitely to protect them from sun. And yeah, we were looking at these species and seeing like, what can they do? What happens when UV hits them? So we were looking at how do they repair their DNA? How do they respond? Can they repair? And they can. You know, overnight they repair their DNA and then they get going the next day. The hot spring water itself has got all these crazy different metals and chemicals within it because it's going up through the mantle of the Earth in superheated conditions.
Ah, this is the superhero power source, superheated hot spring UV-defying algae in rainbow colours. It sounds like it's made up, but it's real.
It's superheated water in the centre is about 125 degrees. And then at the edge, it cools off and then you start to get all these colours and these groups called chloroflexes and all these different archaebacteria all work together in these little biofilms and they all talk to each other at different levels. And then slowly further away, our little algae kick in and the little offstreams from that. So it's very cool.
It is super cool. And what a rad thing to be involved in when you're a young researcher. But something happens on the world stage that upsets the apple cart.
So it was two things that happened, actually. About 2 months after I got there, September 11th happened. That was one pretty crazy scenario. And then after that, the Columbia disaster. And it was really, really horrific.
That's where the shuttle broke apart when the astronauts were trying to attempt re-entry and it killed 7 people on board.
The whole crew that went up on the Columbia missions were all being trained at our base because we were the life sciences base. I had a few colleagues who, one of them was doing the filters for the wee, you know, the wee that you drink. So you wee and then you basically filter it out. You drink it if you're an astronaut. But one of the lads was working on that. And one of the other crew was working with these guys who were doing the, what they call payloads. So all of the biological experiments. So yeah, it was a strange time. I mean, and then at that time it was like, right, okay, they'd already been doing the Mars missions. So they were already looking at automated kit that you can drop on the surface of a planet and let it go and do its stuff. This was just, no, you know, we are definitely never going to be sending any more people to space.
On ABC Radio National, this is What the Duck. And I'm Dr. Anne Jones with a super scientist origin story for you. With space research put on hold for Diane Purcell, she went back to seeking the weird and wonderful life forms right here on Earth. They do still have a sort of spacey name, though. They're called hyperliths.
Again, crazy little algae that live on quartz rock. They're a thing called hyperliths. Basically, they're just little communities that live right between the soil and the rock.
Tiny organisms, algae, fungi, and cyanobacteria.
And the light runs through the quartz. There's a little bit of light that can pass through quartz crystals.
That filtered light is one of the reasons they can live in incredibly harsh environments. The quartz acts like a rocky sunscreen.
And they've got this tiny amount of light in a very, very dry environment, looks a bit like moonscape environment. And again, another extreme group of species that I had a colleague was interested in those, so I helped him work on that.
Dr. Diane Purcell, it's like she can't say no to adventure.
Yeah, weird environments, the weirder the better was the thing at the time, you know, nobody really knew what any of them were. You know, about 300 base pairs of from a DNA was about all we were able to access at the time, kind of from methodologies that we had. And that was enough to say, ooh, this was something new.
What I'm getting the impression of, right, is that in some ways your career has embraced the opposite of your childhood. Because what you describe as where you come from is quite bucolic and green and rolling hills and a good, stable sort of home life, a little bit conservative maybe, being taught by nuns. And then as an adult, what you've done is invested all your time in going to the corners of the earth that are the weirdest places and looking into evolution and looking at all of the ways that these creatures that surely did God create. It's sort of the opposite of your upbringing.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, at the end of the day, one of the largest exports that Ireland has ever produced is its people. You know, we do tend to travel. But like, I really, you know, I always wanted to travel. But for me, evolutionary biology was always interesting. Like, how things evolve, why things change, what is making this thing tick, and also a lot of these organisms, a lot of the stuff about Yellowstone that's fascinating is it is a kind of a look back at what the planet was like when it was starting to kind of form. You didn't have breathable air. You didn't have conditions that humans could function in. And there's these little organisms that are like, you're looking at a hot spring and you've got all the steam coming off the top and then you've got this pile of yellow powder. And it's pure sulfur that's just been basically metabolized. These, you know, sulfur-loving bacteria are just basically taking up these different chemical parts of sulfur. What ends up happening is that it condenses out of the steam and you end up with this pure pile of sulfur. I mean, if you're in a lab and somebody gave you a pile of this to do XYZ experiment, you'd be going, this is awesome. And this is insane. So these organisms have these really very specific characteristics.
Oh, a very specific set of skills. Is it okay for Liam Neeson to make a cameo in the sci-fi film of your life, Diane?
Yeah.
I wanted to fast forward you to you're living in Australia, and was it always as easy to find scientific work as it was in that early period of your career?
Oh, look, I think research is always fickle. We're not actors, but it's not far off it in some ways because they're short-term contracts. Nowadays, students are coming through and they get a one-year postdoc, which is just after your PhD, which back in when I started doing research, PhD would last definitely 3+ years and then postdoc would usually be 2 or 3 years. So it is hard, yeah. So I ended up in Australia. I was working with a couple of different groups in Canberra and then a position came up in Darwin and they said, well, normally people go to Darwin to disappear, Diane, or maybe they're from the French Foreign Legion. But it's up to you. If you want to take that job, go for it. And I said, well, it's a 3-year job, lads. It's a 3. And they said, yeah. I was working on the algae in the harbour up in Darwin and I had my son. And it was at the end of that 3-year period, myself and I think it was my 12 colleagues, we were all working. Everybody disappeared off to the corners of Australia and everywhere else. And I was looking at this and going, I'm not sure if this is going to, if we've got a I've got a house up here, I've got to stay. So I ended up switching over and doing a teaching degree. For me, with the teaching, I had tutored for about 20 years before while I was doing all my other research stuff just to keep the lights on and buy a car, I remember at one point, yeah. And it was interesting. I talked to a lot of colleagues of mine at the time. A lot of researchers I've worked with then and since have all said the same. A lot of them went out back and did a teaching degree because there was lulls in their careers too. So it's a hard, it's not an easy career, you know. It is not a, it's buying a house is always like an iffy prospect just from the fact that you may not end up with a job there for long periods.
Even a woman born for adventure, adaptable as an algae in the dark, can find the uncertainty of modern academia weighing them down.
You love what you do, but the positions are not always easy to find.
Unluckily for her school students in the NT, but luckily for algae, Diane Purcell has the energy of 1,000 suns in supernova mode, and soon she'd be awarded a fellowship to go to New Zealand.
I did a Marie Curie fellowship after I did my teaching.
Though COVID did sort of wreck that timing-wise, and she ends up back in Australia.
Some of my colleagues, we've been touching base regarding different elements, and a lot of it is now products from algae and seaweeds are becoming really of interest. Loved the blue skies research at NASA. It was very cool. But from a long-term perspective, from a science perspective, it's like, where are we going to get the funding to do any of this stuff? People are going to have to want to care about what we're up to. So what are we going to do? And that tends to be something that does sit in your mind when you're writing research grants and you're trying to say, like, if I was somebody who's trying to fund this, why would I think it was interesting? So there's a pragmatism that's got to kick in at some point.
Pragmatic, yes, perhaps. But that is coming from a woman who currently is working out of Hobart, but living on a boat. Perhaps someone like Diane will never be able to sit still, and that's actually her true superpower. It's a slightly rude question, but what do you think that old age looks like for someone who clearly has a restless science soul, probably never going to sit still?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Look, now I live on my boat, which is interesting. And I'm not sure if I always live on my boat. I see some of the other older boat owners that I know and they've gone from sailboats to motorboats because everything breaks and you can't pull things as easy as you could when you were smaller. But definitely, I think getting down to Antarctica, I'd still really like to get down and do some sampling down there, see what weird and wonderful species are down there. A lot of work's been done down in that space now. So I'd still like to potentially get my oar in down there, see what they're up to.
Okay, retirement plan is Antarctica.
If you imagine that, say, you are James Bond and you've got all those resources that you're able to have a gizmo or a gadget or a uniform made that enables you to do something amazing that would help you in the field, what would it be?
Wow. I think deep ocean stuff is definitely a space that we'd, yeah, if you could have some kind of, was it the Lotus, the Bond car with the Lotus,
yes.
The white one?
Yeah. That, but for deep ocean stuff. Yeah, we can do that. We can do that. Let's see. We'll put a call out.
Yeah. Deep ocean or deep space. What are the other? That was the one thing at NASA, actually, I thought maybe they'd go for, which was the one-way ticket. And I said, you know what, if they gave me a one-way ticket, I'd probably take it. You know, like if, you know, it's end up on Mars or the moon or whatever, because, you know, what could beat that? So, but yeah, so you never know. I don't think they'll let any humans. I definitely wouldn't pass the psych test for that stuff, probably, you know, but what can you do?
I guess you can subscribe to What the Duck so that in the future, our official Martian correspondent, Dr. Diane Purcell, can report back from her adventures. But for now, she's a superhero of super weird What the Duck things that you can find right here on Earth, which is where we make What the Duck on Wadawurrung and Tungwurrung country in the Kulin Nation. It's made by Rebecca McLaren and me, Anne Jones, for ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.